Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Just Get Started podcast. I'm your host, Brian Andrako, and thanks again for being a part of this journey. On today's episode, I welcome in Joe DeSena, who is the founder and CEO of Spartan, the world's leading endurance sports brand. Growing up in working-class Queens, DeSena has demonstrated an entrepreneurial spirit since his preteens. He built a multi-million dollar pool cleaning business before moving to Wall Street, where he started his own trading firm. In 2001, DeSena fled Wall Street for Riverside Farm in rural Vermont. It was during this time that he discovered his passion for adventure races and endurance events, and Spartan Race was born. DeSena has built Spartan into a global fitness and wellness brand with a 10 million plus community of athletes across the globe. Under his leadership, Spartan's portfolio of brands has grown to include Spartan Trail, Deca, Laruda, Tough Mudder, and Highlander. A New York Times bestselling author, DeSena's latest book, 10 Rules for Resilience, Mental Toughness for Families, hit bookstores last October. I hope y'all enjoy this conversation with Joe. I know I did. Without further ado, please welcome in Joe DeSena. Joe, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you today.
Thanks for having me. This is awesome. Super pumped.
I'm super pumped to chat with you, especially kind of understanding your background a little bit. I want to dive so much deeper just to kind of figure out how do we help them get started? I know a lot of folks struggle. They get stuck. There's a lot of fear there. And I think with your background, obviously, you can give them some good insight. What I thought would be a fun spot to start, and it's actually funny, my son is reading this book called When to Jump. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Mike Lewis. I'm trying to get him into this from an entrepreneurial standpoint. And it just made me think, as I was looking at your background, we all have these kind of like trigger moments, these inflection points, these things that we don't know if they're going to be big at the time, but they seem like they become that. And I found this in 2000, something happened up in Quebec. Is this going to ring a bell here? That it seemed like that might have been a huge change in your life of your thinking. And I could be wrong on that, but can we start there? I'm kind of curious how that came about and maybe what you learned from that experience.
Yeah, but before we get to Quebec, let's go way back and I'll tell you how I ended up in Quebec.
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
I was in Queens. If you've seen the movie Goodfellas, ground zero for organized crime. My mom, in an effort to try to save her mother who had cancer, walked into a health food store, which was pretty odd because there weren't any Whole Foods or Yoga Journals back then. There was this one health food store, probably in the whole East Coast. Hmm. Incense was burning. I was a very young boy. And she meets a yogi, an old yogi, just landed at Kennedy Airport, came in from India. And he convinces her on the spot to save her mom and to save herself and her family. She's got to start doing yoga. She's got to meditate. She's got to work on her breathing. She's got to take cold showers. She's got to do long distance running.
Wow.
She's got to eat a vegan lifestyle. All before Instagram influencers and any of the stuff, you know, before Wim Hof, before it all.
Right.
And so my mom brings home this package of goodies, basically, from the health food store. There was no raviolis in the bag or cannolis or the things we were used to, right? And not too long after, my parents get divorced for obvious reasons. My mom brings us up to Ithaca, New York. But for years, we've got monks in our living room chanting. We've got my mother preaching this different lifestyle, and I don't want any part of it. It is too wacky. Yeah. My friends can't understand it. I can't understand. I just want to make money. And so I'm dying to get out of Ithaca and get back to the neighborhood. I end up building a business in the neighborhood. Years later, I find myself on Wall Street. I find myself in the mix on a trading desk, and I'm not feeling healthy. And so here I am, probably late 20s, and I go find an adventure race. And that leads to another adventure race. When people say, you know, what's an adventure race? Well, it was biking, kayaking, running. They were kind of all over the world in different formats. Wasn't a real sport yet, but it was kind of on the fringe. It was, you know, early to mid 90s. And every time I did one of these things, I felt alive, like really alive. And I started training, doing yoga, and I started realizing, oh my God, all that quackery from my mom, everything she said was right. Mm. And I so much fun with it. I said to my friends that I was racing with, what's the toughest race in the world? Like, let's just step it up. What are we doing playing around with, you know, these things? And they said, well, toughest race in the world is the Iditarod, you know, a dog sled race across Alaska, but we do it on foot. But if we're going to do that, we got to go do this race in Quebec called the Yucatec, and that'll get us ready for the toughest race in the world. And so I guess I'm in my early 30s and we head to Northern Quebec, and it's Canada and it's beautiful and it's cold. And I trained really hard, because what happens in life is when you take on something for the first time, you take it really seriously. You don't know what to expect. I'll never train that hard again when I reflect back on all these crazy things I've done, because I had confidence that I could finish anything I took on. So I didn't need to try. I didn't push myself to limits I did on that first crazy event in Quebec. So I trained really hard. I went out to Vail, Colorado for about 12 days. And I lived like a monk. I had very limited food. I got this little tiny room 2 miles from the mountain. And I'd wake up, you know, 4 a.m. and I'd hike to the top of Vail twice a day. And then I'd go out on cross country skis later that day. And I'd do, you know, 10, 15 miles. I was cold. I was hungry. I was tired. But I did 12 days in a row. And when we get out to Quebec to the start of that race, it was minus 30, but I was prepared because I had done that training. And the question you asked was, you know, what happened out there? Well, there was a moment where we got stranded. I was literally hanging off a cliff. We had to bury ourselves in a pile of snow and sleep in there for the little bit of sleep we could get, and the, you know, the temperatures as they were. And it was really a matter of touch and go. It was a place where you know, I just want water, food, and shelter. But on that edge, because we were, you know, they said, where you guys are, there's never been human beings like where we were racing. Yeah. So on that edge, even though it's touch and go, you feel so alive, so alive. That it triggered something. And I said, I want to do this. I want to do this for life. And I want to introduce other people to it. And so probably for 4 or 5 years post that moment in the snow, that touch and go moment, I would think about, how do I turn this into a business? Mm. So you're right. I mean, that was a pivotal moment.
Well, there's a lot of things there. I appreciate you sharing that. Well, I want to go back quick and then maybe we'll jump forward. But because you mentioned like the training, it was the hardest thing you had done. You never did anything like it, though. How do folks, because this is something that comes up a lot. I mean, I've dealt with this. I'm sure you have at other points, too, is like, especially those 12 days, let's say, in Vail, and you're going back and you're just getting beat up day after day. Like, how do you keep getting up and doing that? Because it's easy to just say, you know what? I gave it my best effort. I'm not going to do the race. But gosh, I did 7 days, you know. How, because I feel a lot of folks just quit at the first sign of adversity. And I think we all do that at times. How did you get past that?
First off, if you had my wife on this podcast, she would say, that's nothing. You should try living with him for 20 years. So I'm relentless, like relentless. It doesn't stop ever. You know, this morning, my workout partner at 6 a.m. said to me, I was kind of hoping that since I flew in from Norway last night, that since you got in late from Norway, that you'd be pushing the workout to 8 or 9 a.m. And I didn't realize you'd say we're still on at 6 a.m. And we did it. And as he said that this morning, I thought, the standards never change. Like I've said that enough to myself, and I've said it enough publicly that I've etched it into my brain that this is what we do. And I'm trying really hard to etch it into my family's brains since the kids were born. And I'm trying really hard to etch it into the world's brains. Now, the problem we all have, the reason we quit, as you described, it's really simple. Our brains are not optimized to do hard stuff. they're actually optimized to take it easy. For most of our existence on Earth, we didn't have an abundance of food, fuel, warm temperatures, hot shit. We didn't have any of that. So the brain, in order to survive as long as we have as a species, is designed as a circuit breaker to shut off those crazy thoughts of walking out across a desert or to crossing, a river that's cold or whatever, not eating something sugary because it has so many dense calories. We might not see food again 5,000 years ago. So eat the cannoli while it's available. Right. You're going to wish you did. But in today's world, obviously, we have the warm showers. We have the climate controlled rooms. We have an abundance of sugary stuff. And our brains are still optimized for 5, 10, 15,000 years ago. So you have to recognize that. That's step one. It's step one in understanding why we quit. That'd be a cool name title for a book, Why We Quit. There you go. We got to write that as a book. And so if you know that, if you understand that you're hardwired to quit, then we can take the first step forward at not quitting. And so the way I've changed my brain is I made it more painful to quit. I regret any time I stop. I'm embarrassed if I have to tell other people that I didn't wake up early this morning and do the workout, or if I came back from Vail and said I only made it 4 days, or if I didn't finish that race in Quebec, even though for a moment we were fighting for our lives, right? So what do you do? I give speeches on this all around the world. The first thing you do is figure out your why. Why are you doing this thing? The thing might be a marathon. The thing might be a marriage. It might be starting a business. You got to start with the why. Because if you don't have the why nailed, you're probably going to quit when the going gets tough, which might be before you even get to the starting line. It might be in the example we just talked about. It might be the training in Vail where you quit. So you got to nail your why. And then you got to commit. Number one, why. Number two, commit. But I mean commit like the marathon monks in Japan. Who are the marathon monks in Japan? If you and I wanted to become monks in Mount Hiei in Japan, they've been there for 800 years, we would raise our hand, knock on the door. We want to be monks. We both shave our heads. We put on robes and sandals. And for 100 days in a row, we would go do 25 miles on their mountain. And so they would know we're committed, we're serious. And we would high five at the end of 100 days and we'd say, we did it, we're in. And they'd say, hold on, we now know you're serious. Take this sword, take this rope, you have 800 more days to go. If you decide to quit, because you said you were committed, if you decide to quit, you got to kill yourself on the course. That's the kind of commitment we're talking about. Not to sound ridiculous and extreme, but hard things, marriage, business, job, like, to be at the level of Michael Jordan or whatever your level of Michael Jordan is as a human being requires that kind of commitment with a sword and a rope. Or be like everybody else and quit.
No.
It's okay. But you're not going to be one of the 1%. It's okay. Right? So number one, get your why nailed. Why do you want to be a marathon monk? Why do you want to be the best basketball player? Why do you want to be the best family man? Nail that, your purpose, and commit like a marathon monk, commit like your life depends on it, and then get ready for the ride, because it's going to be, there's nothing worth doing in life that's not going to be hard, that's not going to try to buck you off the saddle 5,000 times. And just when you think, and I, as I'm talking, I'm thinking about 500 examples in my own life. Just when you think you're there and you could smell the burgers and hear the music at the finish line, there's like a punch in the face and five more things that go wrong.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think that's kind of the almost the metaphor of life is like, it's not so much about that destination, but the journey, you know, and you even mentioned something earlier, kind of made me think of, you know, the word preparation. It's like that when you're in Vail and you're doing the hike, we go back to that, each day. You're just putting the tools in place to give yourself the opportunity to do that race. Because obviously, if you didn't train at all, oh my gosh, I can imagine, you know, what day two would look like up there. So you're preparing. And I think that's where, if you agree, I'm kind of curious where you'd go with this. Like, folks struggle because they don't put new tools into play. They don't change their schedule, let's say. They don't, if they're having issues with their marriage, they don't say, wow, you know what, why don't we just do a date night this week? We haven't done one in 6 months. You know, like little small tweaks to help prepare for a better journey. Do you find that's the case as well, as setting yourself up for success?
Well, remember, I wasn't in Vail 3 years earlier or 5 years earlier, 7 years earlier, because I didn't have that date on the calendar that was pending. Hmm. I was going to enter the ring and get my ass kicked in Canada, and I had to train. We notice UFC fighters, boxers, military men and women, we see them get out of shape and then get back in shape when they're going to be deployed, when they're going back to the ring to go in a fight. So I learned very early on that I had to have a date on my calendar. Most of us do. I mean, quite honestly, we all need it. I mean, if we didn't need dates on calendars, we wouldn't need professors at school, right? You wouldn't need foremen on construction jobs. Like, right, people would just do it, but we don't, for the reasons we said earlier, the way our species and our brain is designed. So you got to get a date on the calendar. And then I believe you do the work and gain the tools you're talking about. Otherwise you just don't do the work.
Well, let's go back to what the word you mentioned earlier is relentless, because I kind of take that myself. I always like to throw something on there. Like, I actually signed up for my first marathon. It'll be at the end of this year. Nice. I'll eventually do a Spartan race, a big one. And that'll be my goal down the road.
Where do you live?
I live in Raleigh, North Carolina.
All right. There's no way out. You're screwed. You're doing the North Carolina Spartan race. And that is going to be, that's going to be your Vail to getting ready for the marathon.
Oh gosh. Is that the one April 6th I saw?
Whatever it is, get you through it.
Okay.
You can invite all your listeners for free. It's on me, including yourself, no charge. Anybody that wants to meet you out there, you're doing it. I don't want to hear no. And I promise you, it'll change everything.
Okay. I'm game. Well, because I signed up for the Tar Heel 10 miler. It's April 20th. So as long as the dates don't conflict, I don't think they do, I'm game, dude. Let's do it.
Awesome.
I appreciate you pushing me on that. But what I was getting to, I didn't expect to be challenged there, but I like that. This is actually something too, actually. Let's go back to relentless, is putting things on the calendar. It makes you have to break out of your comfort zone. Otherwise, we get into this spin each and every day. It's like I do the same thing over and over and over again. So I think putting stuff like that on the calendar is important. So relentless. I'm gonna land the plane here. Did you always have that somewhere and it just kind of came out in this form? Like, did you have that when you were starting your businesses as a kid and stuff? Or is this something, do you think, I guess, can that be taught? Or is that something innate, do you believe? And people have to figure out a way to pull it out of themselves.
I go back and forth on it, because as a young person, I didn't have it channeled. But, you know, if the sunlight hit my eyes, I sat up like a robot and I had to go do something. So I was always very active. We have four children. A couple of my children definitely have that switch of just like they have to be doing, creating. I see it. I've had 10 million people do one of our events around the world. I can think of a lot of examples where I'm scratching my head and saying, why doesn't that person have any oomph? Why did they like? But I could also think of examples where folks have come into the system. They haven't had the oomph. They haven't had the drive, the relentlessness. Mm-hmm. And then I've watched them change. So I suspect deep down inside, we all have it, but there are layers and layers of cushy cotton that get put on us, right? Built into our DNA, our bodies, our minds, because of the way we live, because we haven't had to forage for food. We haven't had to hunt. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it come out. when I force people to hunt.
Yeah. Do you feel part of the reason the races work is because of accountability? You're not out there by yourself. You have, there is a group there, whether it's friends or not.
Yeah, I think, you know, you tell people you're signed up. You don't want to be embarrassed. There's 8,000 people out there with you. They help you get through it. And it feels really good. I sound like I'm selling, but like I said, if there's somebody out there that's, you know, part of your community wants, it's free. It's not like I'm not selling. It just feels really good. I think about those days when I started, you just don't feel alive in your own comfort zone. You don't.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes too, as you mentioned, if you've never done anything hard or to that extent, having other people around it that are going into the battle with you, I think it gives you just a little bit more support and comfort that, hey, you know, this is okay. Like I'm not going to be alone. If I fail, someone's there with me, you know?
No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
So as you think about, I want to go back. So we'll kind of connect the dots here. I want to circle back. So going back to 2001, so you're on Wall Street and you transition, right? And part of obviously 2000 was part of that. When did this idea spark of actually like the way that Spartan is now, or just the business in general, when did that idea really spark of like, this is going to be a business that I'm going to do and I'm going to leave Wall Street? Can you share kind of the ideation phase and how the first steps of getting started were?
You know, in the early, like I'm a big believer, I coined the term fire ready aim. You know,
that was you. Okay. Years. I've heard that before. Okay, good.
There's a lot of people, you know, talk about getting ready, aiming, but you never really pull the trigger. So right. I fire first. And I took that shot in 2001 and I didn't really know what it was, but we were going to put on grueling events that change people. And we iterated and iterated and iterated for a decade. I lost money. And then in 2009, we changed the name to Spartan, we changed the format, and all of a sudden people started coming. Let's go down that rabbit hole for a second. There's a, you know, most businesses fail in the first year, but it's really not the business, it's the jockey. Will the jockey pivot? Will the jockey listen to the customers and keep iterating until they get a product or service that customers want? If they're stuck in their ways and they're convinced that the thing they're selling, everybody has to have, but nobody's buying it. Well, they, you know, they're not listening.
Yeah.
So I listened. It took me longer than it should have, but I listened, I iterated, I listened. And then we finally struck gold. And then even then 2009, 2010, it evolved. It just kept, and it keeps getting edited. Now we just keep editing it. Mm.
What was the first initial idea that you had?
The initial idea was a crazy obstacle race with Richard Branson down on the British Virgin Islands. And It was 350 miles long. It included sailing, kayaking, biking, running. It was crazy. And we lost a guy. Oh. We lost a guy for 8 days. He was in a dinghy. He was helping us set up some ropes. And nobody noticed. He drifted away. The engine wouldn't start on this little boat. And some terrible storms rolled in the British Virgin Islands. And when we found out this guy was missing, crazy to me that no one noticed he was missing. We found out 8 days later he was missing. We borrowed Richard's helicopter. My father-in-law is a helicopter pilot. Jumped in with Richard's helicopter pilot and myself. And we started flying around. And we got the Coast Guard involved. And we laid out maps. And the Coast Guard figured out if he was alive and you last saw him here, he would have drifted here. And we found him 150 miles away on Little Tobago, and he was alive. And so, you know, anybody normal would have packed it in at that point and said, hey, I'm not putting on races anymore. That's a little too dangerous for me, but I'm a glutton for punishment. And we iterated from there. I stayed away from large, vast, open swaths of ocean. And we put on another event, another event, another event. And then, like I said, 2009, it became Spartan.
Well, do you remember like the aha moment of when you pivoted to maybe what it currently is today? And I know you said you've continued to change, but Like, was there like one distinct moment, or was it just kind of just randomness over time that?
You know, I hit up two friends. It was post financial crisis, 2008, 2009. And I said, I'm done. I can't keep investing in this thing. It's not working. People are too lazy. And I'll give it one more shot. I'm only putting $50,000 more into this thing, short distances, not 300 miles, you know, and 700 people showed up. And then 1500 and 3000, it just kept growing and growing and growing.
Wow.
So, you know, I think that's an example of being really close to the end of the tunnel you've been digging for 12 years and you want to quit. And you don't realize that 4 inches away, if you punch through the tunnel, you'll be out the other side.
Yeah.
And how many of us in life just give up too soon?
Yeah. I guess the question is always, you know, because is there like a survivorship bias with that, right? Of, you know, I think this comes up a lot. It's like, or is there things like you can pull? And I'm curious, even your own journey, and I know you've interviewed a ton of different folks that have been very successful. Are there threads that you can tie together that if someone's listening, like, I'm going to start a business or I want to try something, like two or three things that are really impactful they should be considering in that first year or two to make sure at least it gets in some direction that's capable to have a chance for success?
In business, you mean, in that first year or two, what should they do?
Yeah. What are some things they, because again, I think a lot of folks will listen in and they might be like, yeah, 12 years is a lot, Brian or Joe, to kind of go through, like, will it take that long? Or did you see some things, you know?
Yeah. Listen, I was on a podcast with the Lovesack founder. He makes a really awesome couch, and he and I have become friends, which is the most unlikely friendship because I don't believe in couches. And he sells couches. My other friend owns Saks Fifth Avenue, another unlikely friendship because he carries around two little poodles. He says, don't call them poodles. And I carry around a rusty 83-pound chain, but we're friends. And, you know, we talked about this idea for both those guys that have 25-year-old overnight successes. In other words, it takes a long time. And so for that person that's listening out there, how the hell would you survive taking losses for 10, 12 years? Does it really take that long? It doesn't always, but it probably does. And so you got to have some other way to feed yourself along the way, right? You've got to be able to survive along the way because it's very, very rare that you wake up and something is wildly successful and able to feed you. Yeah, in those early days, I lived in my family's house. My first business was cleaning swimming pools at 12 years old. I couldn't make that work financially, but if I wasn't, I got fed at my house. I lived under my father and mother's roof. I couldn't make it work otherwise. But then I got it to a point where it became a teenager. You know, it was an infant, and I had to keep feeding it, and then eventually becomes a teenager, and it could stand on its own.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the consistency of like continuing, and this goes obviously to the fitness analogy, is like you keep putting the reps in. There's only so many hours in the day. You can't work on it just one day and then expect it to all of a sudden be good. It's a continual progression over time. And it seems like the person that stays in it the longest has a chance to win, whatever win is.
I am absolutely convinced that it is a game. Life is a game of endurance. Business is a game of endurance. Marriage is like, can you just keep waking up and keep doing it?
Yeah.
Because 99%, you don't even have to be the fast. Like, they just drop off.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
We had 800 competitors when I started. Everybody with a screw gun and a hammer and a nail decided that, you know, they were going to get in the obstacle course race business. And, you know, 798 of them packed it in.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of people, even with the podcast, like they'll ask, and obviously I do a lot of other stuff besides just this, but like, you know, I'm in year 7, and I remember when I started in 2017, and I have folks that ask, like, wow, Brian, that's a lot of episodes and stuff. I'm like, I only take it one at a time. Like, I'm not thinking 10 years out. Like, I would love to do this 5, 10 years from now, right? That means I'm still here and I'm still healthy enough to do it and whatever, but I'm like, it's chopping the wood each day and enjoying it along the way. And I think if we get so short-sighted, to your point, it's kind of like the New Year's resolution, right? I'm sure you get this all the time, right? Folks, like, they're going to go to the gym 2-3 hours. They haven't gone to the gym once last year, but now all of a sudden they're going to be committed. Instead of just saying, why don't I do some push-ups and, you know, air squats today and then do it tomorrow and then build up, right? I think we get overcommitted and then we just burn the hell out. Do you see that the most maybe with folks is they have this big goal, but they haven't really broken it down into smaller chunks to start?
It really is. It really is a requirement to hitting the target is, you know, taking, how do you eat an elephant, right?
Yeah.
You take bite size pieces and you just chew it till it's done. And you can get overwhelmed. You can get excited, like you said, at New Year's, but it is just a game of endurance, a little bit at a time. One of my boys became completely addicted to training. No surprise, because I drove all four of my children absolutely crazy since they're little kids. And it got to the point where I was like, no, come on, I want to take a ride and we're going to go to the movie or something. He's like, God, I got 6 more minutes on the treadmill. I'm like, wow, it's flipped the other way. And the reason I was telling him not to, because I was afraid exactly what you said, that like if you push too much. I was on a flight yesterday. I told you I was coming back from Norway and I saw that NFL show on the plane. I don't know, it's called Hard Knocks.
Oh, yeah.
Showing, you know, the Dallas Cowboys. And they were holding back at the beginning of the season. They were holding back their top athletes from burning out, from you know, they let them out of the corral, you know, and then all of a sudden they burn themselves out, they get injured. So there is, for survival, if it is a game of attrition, and you and I believe it is, and it's really last man or last woman standing, then go slow, but just be consistent.
Yeah. Don't stop. Yeah. It doesn't
stop.
Yeah. Small little chunks. How do you, I guess, and maybe this will be a good place to wrap up our conversation today around the parenting side of things. You know, I have an 11.5-year-old. I'm trying to get him active and, you know, trying to get him off the video games as much as I can. Although I think there's a benefit to that. I do believe there's a benefit to some of that as well. But how do you think about this parenting for kids? I'm sure you get other parents asking you about fitness and those type of things. What are your thoughts on getting kids active with a healthier lifestyle in today's world?
Well, a couple of things. I came into the world slightly. I had our four children come into the world slightly at a disadvantage because the phone was already developed. When I grew up, it was a payphone. Mm-hmm. It was easier for me and more likely that we would be active and outside. We got a lot of our environment working against us as parents because, I mean, you don't see kids on sidewalks anymore. You don't see them in parks. You just earlier, and in full disclosure, all four of our children have phones and it's disgusting. And I'm a crazy person. I mean, I've been pushing our kids pretty hard most of their life. And these phones are hands down the most, I mean, this has got to be worse than crack cocaine. Yeah. I can't tell you the fights I get in with the kids to pull their phone away. And by the way, I'm on my phone nonstop. Now I make the excuse to my kids, which is true. I'm doing business.
Right.
I'm not staring at nonsense, but these things are disgusting. And all I can say is if you could set up some kind of policy in the house where, listen, for you to earn the phone for the rest of the day or the rest of the week or whatever it may be, we're going to get this workout done. The way I approached it for most of their life was we're doing 2-a-days every day, 7 days a week. And I created this little group of animal movements that could be done if they were listening. Kids usually don't listen, but if they're listening and they were getting after it, they could get it done 10 minutes, but it would take us an hour because there was a lot of, you know, back and forth and agitating and convincing and nudging, but they could get it done in 10 minutes. And we did it every day, twice a day, 7 days a week for about 8 years. And then they found their sport and now they've got coaches and they do, you know, they're doing it with their teammates. And so that's easier. But if you don't do that, if you're a parent and you don't force that function, They're not getting it in school. They're not getting it. So you've got to give it to them. Now, it could be you giving it to them as a gymnastics class twice a day, but not everybody has access to that. It could be, you know, some other sport at a young age. Problem I have with that is at young ages, they don't really push the kids that hard from a physical fitness standpoint. Gymnastics would, but, you know, most of the, like, I remember watching them play soccer at a young age, and I was like, and my wife was a very high level soccer player. I was like losing my mind because they weren't doing much, you know, why aren't they doing pull-ups? Why aren't they doing push-ups?
Yeah.
So anyway, I created an environment. If there were stairs and an escalator, we took the stairs. If we were getting on a big flight, we were doing burpees, even if it meant in the airport. We were not going to get on a 10-hour flight going somewhere without having exercise that day. Didn't matter if it was Sunday. Didn't matter if it was a birthday. We were doing the work. And they're four very fit, very confident kids now because of that. No secret sauce other than we did it every day.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good ritual to put in, I think. I mean, certainly hard on the kids, you know, but I think they learn that, that work ethic's important.
For anybody listening that's, you know, there's probably 50% of your audience that's saying he's a nutcase, that's terrible for the kids or this or that. Just remember that there are kids in Africa that are walking 10 miles every day carrying buckets of water to get water. Don't be ridiculous and say, like, my 7-year-old, because of that ritual, ran the New York Marathon. Didn't break any records, but we went out. We had an awesome day together. His brother, 8 years old, ran the Boston Marathon. The daughter ran the Beast, which you're going to do in North Carolina. And she was 6. And so my point is, none of this is dangerous. It's super healthy for the kids. And most importantly, the real reason to do it, I had all those hours with our kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's something too, I think, to kind of loop around on that, like something I put into play probably about 2 years ago, probably during COVID, was at minimum, we do a walk every day after school. At minimum. Now, I'm a single dad, so I only have them every other week. So for me, I mean, the quality times are really as quality as I can get, right? Anytime's quality, I guess. But we're walking around, no phones, no tech, because it's a chance for me to just talk to him, because otherwise it's hard to pull him off. And I think that's, if for parents listening in, yeah, just slip something in, start somewhere. It could be small, but figure out a way to get off your phone as well as get them off theirs. And I think that's an opportunity.
In your situation, you got to convince your wife, and now's the perfect time. I don't know how far away you live from him, that you could meet him every morning at 6 a.m. or something before school and just get a little workout in. You gotta convince your wife. Not easy. I know there's dynamics, family dynamics and all that, but moms, I don't know your ex, your situation, but my moms in general, and I'm sure all the women listening are gonna want to kill me, they're optimized to make it safer and more cushy for the kid. That was their job for as long as, you know, we've been a species. Men are training the kid for something different, which is survival.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, my wife would have never pushed the kids the way I pushed the kids. And I would have never coddled, like, she brought another whole dynamic to the table, which was good. I would have never coddled them and hugged them like she did, right? So anyway, I would say quickly get on that.
No, I'm like, well, it's funny when we were obviously talking, which I appreciate you bringing up the Beast, which I have to look at what that is for this race. But when I was looking prior, because I was thinking that would be do a Spartan race with him and have him do one. Because I think he could probably do, I think there's a 5K one. He could probably do the 5K.
He could do any one of them.
Okay. So the obstacles aren't like where he can't climb up or get over.
If he can't do that obstacle, he does a penalty loop or he does burpees. No big deal.
Oh, okay. Oh, gotcha. Okay. I like that. All right. Joel, this is a lot of fun, man. I could probably talk to you for hours here, but any final thoughts, words of wisdom, challenges for the audience, questions, anything you'd ask?
Yeah, the big challenge for your audience, and it'll change everything, is pick one of our events, even if it scares you. I'll give you the race for free. Watch what happens once you commit. Watch what happens. Everything we're talking about here, everything in your life changes because we set the gears in motion.
Yeah. One small step.
That's it.
Now, I know they're going to ask me. They're going to be like, how do I get it for free, Brian? Is there a link I send them?
Why don't you consolidate a list? I don't care if it's 5,000 people. You consolidate a list, all the names, email addresses, and then we'll send everybody a code.
Oh, wow. Okay. Perfect. So this is a lot of fun, man. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you sharing some of your journey.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Hey, everyone. And just one more quick thing before you head off on your day. If you're enjoying this podcast and are looking for other resources and tools to help you get started and move forward toward a happier and more fulfilling life, then I'd encourage you to head over to my website, brianandraco.com, and hit the subscribe button in the upper right corner. There you can find my newsletter and blog subscriptions, where I share insights and information around getting unstuck, perspective, mindset, relationships, habits, and much more. If you get a chance to sign up, I hope you enjoy. Thanks again for listening in, and have a phenomenal day.